This is a download from the BBC. For more information and our terms of use, go to bbc.co.uk/podcasts. I'm Tom Service with BBC Radio 3's Music Matters podcast. Today, 45 minutes with the most sought-after tenor in the world, Jonas Kaufmann, the German singer who has the whole operatic world at his feet, with everywhere from the Metropolitan Opera in New York to La Scala in Milan to Covent Garden in London, building productions, even their seasons, around him. Whether it's his Verdi, or his Wagner. Or, for that matter, his Beethoven, his Giordano, his Mozart, or his Puccini. He's in London at the moment, rehearsing a new production and a new role for him, Des Grieux, in Puccini's Manon Lescaut at the Royal Opera House. And then there are his performances and recordings of Lieder, absolutely essential to Kaufmann's life in music, like Schubert's Winterreise, with which he recently transfixed an audience at Covent Garden. But it wasn't always this way. The 44-year-old Munich-born singer has had to battle to get to where he is today, to come to terms with his voice, a different instrument to the one his early teachers and employers thought he had, which almost destroyed his career in the early 1990s, and to deal with the machinations of the opera world on his terms, refusing roles he's not yet prepared for, despite the endless clamour for him to sing Verdi's Otello or Wagner's Siegfried, and figuring out what's best for him, and not just his legions of fans, who bay for his voice in the nicest possible way all over the world. Actually, talking about Otello and Siegfried, there's some news on both of those roles, as you'll hear. A lot has happened since we last spoke in 2010, all of those recordings we've just heard, for a start. But Jonas' life in music began at home, with his father's record collection and his grandfather playing and singing Wagner at the piano. And this wasn't about the glamour of opera or dreaming to be the pin-up of international tenordom, which is what Jonas Kaufmann has become, but about a simple love of music. I met him after he'd been rehearsing all day at Covent Garden. Jonas, on your website, there's a quite candid about me section where you write very honestly about your relationship with singing, especially how it all started. You say that early on in your career, you're at Saarbrücken, things aren't going particularly well with the voice, and you say the idea of singing at La Scala or the Met seemed as remote as the moon. Now, from the perspective of today, I mean, that was 20 years ago, admittedly, but is that really how it felt?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I would be a fool to say I never deep inside still had the hope, because I think that you need that, because if you don't have hope, you should do certainly something else. But you have to be rational about it, and chances are so unlikely that you can make it all the way to the top. So when you, from the very first moment, actually count on that, all your life will be disappointment. So certainly at that point I was totally convinced that it's never going to happen. And then it happened much earlier than I thought, but in a small role. I did Giacchino in 1998, I think, in Beethoven's Fidelio in La Scala. Nothing to sing, but still, I mean, I really wet in my pants there, because I thought, oh God, the curtain opens, this is La Scala. I was pale. So, yes, of course you get used to it, I have to say. Now it's not the same thrill anymore, but it's still great, of course.
The thing about where this comes from in you, musically speaking, I mean, before you were aware of what you could do as a singer, where does this life for music come from in you?
That's difficult to tell. I mean, I think you either have it or you don't have it. Even musicians, there are two types of musicians. There's one that is extremely passionate about everything and it is only seeking for emotions. And there's the other one that seeks for perfection and technique. I always did belong to the passion section, if you would call it. And my family loved music, so I grew up listening to classical music all the time. And especially to really heavy and meaty classical music, not only Mozart and Bach, but the real things. Mahler, Strauss, Wagner, Bruckner, Shostakovich, things like that, really, with lots of power.
But that wasn't especially opera then. I mean, there was a big symphonic.
It was not opera.
So again, the relationship with your voice, how did that come about? And was that through a bigger immersion in the world of music? And then you decide, actually, I want to be a singer. I want to focus on singing.
If you would have asked me at that time, I thought, I mean, of course, I had some key moments when I saw an opera performance and I realized that I could be part of that, because it is a step further than being a musician in the middle of an orchestra or being accompanied by the orchestra and being in the real set, having costume, makeup, wig, everything. It seemed like the ideal situation to be in if you really want to say something. For me, that was always the case. I loved it. I was, when my parents were having a party, I was telling jokes all night long. So I always tried to entertain the people. I had an older sister who started having piano lessons, and I was jealous all the time because I thought this is a great thing, because obviously, since I didn't have any lessons, I wasn't allowed to touch the piano. And my grandfather was sitting there all the time playing all those Wagner scores. So I wanted to play that instrument. And we went to the teacher, and the teacher said, no, you can't, because it's you're too young. Your hands are too small. And as a substitute, I joined the chorus. And that was really such an extraordinary feeling to be in the middle of the sound, to be surrounded by music. So that was the beginning, and I sang and sang and sang all the time without ever thinking about becoming an opera singer and making that as your profession. Actor, yes, that was maybe more the idea. I mean, I would love to sing and I'd love to play an instrument and everything, and I like music, but you see, as long as you are not capable enough, as long as you're not the master of your instrument, you have no chance in expressing what you really want to express. And that's really painful. I mean, my first years, I would say, studying with Helmut Deutsch, my pianist whom I always do the lead concerts with, he inspired me so much to live it and feel it for real. And I couldn't do it. I could either do it and be with no voice after 5 minutes, because I tried to squeeze out all these sounds that I would want to do, or I could just sing it and be not satisfied myself about it. I remember when I heard the first time the recording of Fritz Wunderlich with Mahler, Songs of the Earth, and I thought, this is so fantastic. It was my first year at music school, so I immediately went to the library, got the music, and I couldn't even sing through the first page because it was impossible. Vom Kummer soll aufmachen in die Seele. Ich trinke. And that was so frustrating because there were so many things that seemed to be so beautiful, and I had no way to do it because I just didn't have the instrument, I thought. But it turned out I didn't have the technique. The problem with singing is it is such a different approach of teaching something. With an instrument, you can show how to hold the violin, how to hold the bow. And that's what makes it so complicated, that your teacher tells you, oh, you know, when you inhale, it is like you're smelling at a rose or something. And when you have open your mouth, it should be like a pear that you put in your mouth because it's smaller in the front but larger in the back, or somebody say a hot potato. All these crazy little images that they give you, that's why we don't have a common language.
But the search is to find what your instrument is, what your natural voice actually is. I mean, in a way, that journey,
sound,
that
yes.
couldn't be simpler in a way. But the difficulty is all everything else that gets in the way. Were there people you were trying to imitate when you were younger?
Of course. I mean, I had many advisors, let's say, who told me you are young and you are German and you should sound very light and bright and like lifted off the ground, and it should, it's very flexible and all these things. So I was listening to recordings from Peter Schreier and these kind of singers, or Blochwitz, or all these small but very flexible, beautiful voices. And I couldn't do it. I mean, I did do it, but I struggled because I realized I had one cold after the other. I always had a sore throat, all these things, only because, I mean, everything inside was in my body was screaming, don't do it. And still I would do it. And then I was listening to Pavarotti, and then I thought, oh, for the Italian, well, this is the one. But it's also not my style. It's just not my technique, and it's not my sound of voice.
So what is your sound of voice, then?
It's the Kaufman voice. That's what it ultimately comes to. Because
how do you describe it? You're fans, and there are hundreds of thousands of them around the world who will use all kinds of adjectives to describe it. How would you describe your voice?
That's very difficult. I mean, it's... The one important ingredient to me is I realized that if I lose the connection to my body, so then I'm lost. It is a safety. It is something very essential for me to sing for a long time in a healthy way. If it sits low, let's say, so the larynx, the voice box is relaxed and sits pretty low, and it stays down there all the time. And many singers have another technique where the voice box goes up, the higher they go, and then they have to push it very low when they sing low notes. And I realized at some point what makes the pitch. It is only these tiny little vocal cords. You stretch them, you have a higher note, and you put them in a more relaxed mode, and then there you have a lower note. So why would we do all these different things in order to achieve high or low note? It's not necessary. It's just our imagination that we think a high note must be reached up there and a low one must be down there. Mm. Totally wrong. And from this point on, I said, well, I want to work on a technique which allows me to sing every note, soft or loud, low or high, with the exact same position, with the same amount of space and everything.
You're not using adjectives, but just to throw some at you, because it's a warmth, it's a lyricism, it's a burnished quality of your voice. It has this depth, and then there are lots of other adjectives like silkiness or beauty and all that stuff. You know, I mean, it comes from this idea of a naturalness in your body and a relationship with your voice. But is it also a question of repertoire, a question of things that you were doing too young, things that you shouldn't have sung, roles that you shouldn't have been pushed to do, that now you're much more conscious of what you take on, what's going to suit what you've got better than anything else?
Well, I think I'm in this situation with having a voice, an instrument, and a technique to be capable in singing many different things, and some quite convincingly. Not everything. I probably don't. I mean, there are many things that Rossini and Donizetti and all the lighter bel canto, which I probably will never do. So these things are over. There's still some dreams to see, maybe singing some Bach again, because I'm absolutely missing this kind of music.
But essentially, that very high bel canto repertoire is not your repertoire. The slightly lower, more lyrical repertoire, whether it's German, whether it's Verdi, Puccini, or whether it's Wagner.
I had to find out also that. I mean, and people had to convince me. And I remember very well when Helmut Rilling, he was famous for his Bach choir in Stuttgart and so on. He wanted to do a concert version of Fidelio, of Beethoven's Fidelio. And it took him a year to convince me to sing Florestan there. I thought it's a stupid idea. And everybody was warning me, don't do it, and it's wrong, and it's difficult, you can hurt your instrument. And I said to myself, well, the only way to find out is I just try it, and I sing it, and I sing it in the room, and suddenly I will know whether I do it. And I studied it, and then I went to a teacher, and I sang it, and she said to me, okay, we sang the whole part now, let's go back. Let's sing the aria one more time. Yes, okay. Let's sing the duet one more time. Yeah, let's sing the finale one more time, which is a, ein solches, which is really, really tricky. And then she looked at me and said, you still got some voice left? I said, yeah, it feels great. And she said, oh, shit, you have to do it. Because it's like driving a muscle car finally on a motorway. And you think, oh, wow, that feels comfortable. I cannot say that this was the goal or this was where I was aiming at. Not at all. I mean, I sang all Mozart parts, so it's not that I skipped all these things and I sang Rossini and I did it all, but I never felt so comfortable as when I started doing the Italian repertory and German repertory.
But essentially, the bigger one.
The bigger it becomes, the more I felt home. I mean, I did, just now, in end of last year, I did Forza del Destino, which many people say,
Verdi,
oh, it's one of
Don
the...
It felt
great. I thought, oh, God, I want more of that. This is fantastic. Because, I don't know, it's just, that's where I feel home.
You've been pretty lucky in that way.
Some
singers must face the situation where what their instrument is best suited for may not be the music that actually they love the most, whereas it seems in a way that however it's happened, you're basically singing pretty well the music you love the best. Is that basically true?
Oh, absolutely. I never said I was complaining about the outcome. I totally feel sympathy with singers that just don't want to accept what they got and they just want more and they push for it so much that then ultimately they struggle. And I'm not sure whether I wouldn't do the same thing, but I know only that it is wrong.
One of the difficulties that you face is the question of planning. You've had a very strict rule, which is that you won't book in a second performance of a role until you've done it once. Now, the difficulty with that is, let's say you want to do Verdi's Otello at some point in the future, hypothetically, although he was hoping it happens.
We're not going to mention any dates.
But let's just say you do it. The point is, if you want to plan in a second performance of that role, which would end up defining one part of your career, you sort of literally can't do that for 5 years because of the way it's planned. Does that frustrate you, the way that the opera world works that way?
Oh, certainly it does. Lately, I've tried to not be that strict anymore, only because it has become insane with 5 years or 6 years ahead. Through the experience that I've had in the last 5 years, 6 years, I can calculate easier. I can estimate what the voice is going to do and how a part is going to feel like. When you talk about Otello, for instance, I just spoke about my experiences from Forza del Destino, and it's pretty much the same thing. There's not such a big difference. I mean, it's, let's say, the very, very last step that you do prior to Otello. So I feel confident enough to yet book another production of Otello, not only one.
But you've got that planned then.
Oh, yes,
okay.
I have.
So Otello is planned, very good.
The Otello is planned, it has to come. I can't wait for that
When
day.
Is it happening for the first time?
When? Oh, God, let me think. When is that? I think it's in the 16-17 season.
Which opera house? Okay, fine. Let's. Yeah. But it's going to happen. That's already a bit of an excuse.
Yeah. Let's
run with it.
The problem is really, I mean, I'm always saying this, the artistical side of this is terrible, of scheduling things in a way where we get stuck with the things that we planned 5 years ago. And not the most terrible things, of course, it's all beautiful, but still, the key is to make your plan in a way that it is not only healthy and physically possible to do. The next thing is, what comes right before, what comes right after, is that possible to do? Or when you have three heavy parts that go all in the same direction. And the third, and for me, most important ingredient, am I still entertained when I'm coming to that point and have to do it? It is so essential that you keep passionate about it. Because when you don't look forward to each of these productions, you will not find the energy to actually do it.
But you see, that speaks to a whole kind of bigger problem about opera in general. The operatic culture is so anti-spontaneous in the way that it's planned, in terms of how you're booked, in terms of the way that these gigantic supertankers of opera houses and the way that the fees work and the whole structure of it is so unbelievably labyrinthine. I just wonder if there's a relationship between those ludicrous mechanics and economics, frankly, about the way that the opera system works and the way that people perceive what you do as an opera star. Because unfortunately, you're part of this. One thing you can't do is change the whole system, however much you'd like to. So unfortunately, you become part of this whole system. You even become a poster boy of the whole thing.
Well, I mean, part of that problem is because, with some only few exceptions, I mean, the Second World War has stopped composers to write beautiful music for eternity. Everything after that is just a statement of what is going on at that moment, and it's outdated in a matter of years. So we are the preservers or conservers of an art form that had its peak way in the past. And it is fascinating. I'm not saying that I don't like opera because it is old. Opera itself is not outdated. And if you have an opera by Puccini or by Verdi or by Mozart or whatever it is, it still works. And it still pushes the button at the right spot. If it's done the right way, of course. I mean, we're talking about something which is very fragile and very delicate, and we have to... I'm totally not against renewing opera in sense of cleaning it up and
In terms of productions?
Yes, exactly. Especially in terms of production, because also we've changed a lot also in the way of how musically interpreting things. But of course, I'm mostly talking about productions and how things have changed there. And I know that the whole movement came from Germany and the German so-called Musiktheater Regie Theater, then
it broadly was just, director's theater.
Yeah, it's the idea is very good, because you need to do something in order to not get stuck.
This is the problem, isn't it? Because if people think, however new the productions might be, some of which may have frustrated you personally being part of them, but whatever, but the sense of ultimately the idea of the music having been written at least 100, if not 200 or 300 years ago, is that essentially all you're doing is singing in a kind of gilded museum.
I'm not sure, because you see, I know things also in science, things change, but there are things that rules that existed a long time ago and that still exist, and especially with our soul and our emotions, we still have the same instincts like our ancestors thousands of years ago. That's why I believe the great opera is based on these instincts, because the basic feelings have never changed. We still fall in love with each other. We still hate each other. We still fear death and all these things. And these are most of the time exactly the things that we're talking in opera. And if you give the piece the chance, even if it's 300 years ago, it will certainly do the same trick.
Just to turn that around, though, you could say exactly the same about new opera. Now, you're Munich-born. I'm thinking about the great, great German post-war operas, above all those of Hans Werner Henze, which for many people amount to some of the most beautiful music written for the opera house. I mean, you could quite easily as a singer decide to say, okay, I'm going to do some of Hentzer's operas over the next 2 or 3 years. This is hypothetical, of course, you know. Yeah. But what I mean is the feelings there, they are exactly the same as the feelings that have been emanated 200 or 300 years ago. But, and yet they also have something to say to us more directly today because it's music of our time. It's music that was written in the last 10, 20 years or so. You could do that if you wanted.
Yeah, that is true. But as I said, I mean, what we forget is if we're talking about a play without music, it is absolutely correct that whether it's a Shakespeare or it's something written last week, we can find a way to make it have the same impact to the audience. Mm-hmm. But if you don't have the melody, if you don't have the ingredient that we, with our brains, can follow, that we can ideally hum a melody on the way home, if it's too complex, too difficult, it is not relaxing anymore. I totally agree. There are some pieces of Hanson that are absolutely great.
Others too, but...
But especially for musicians that are very much into it, not for the person that comes the first time in front of classical music. You need probably musical education in order to appreciate Hentzer's music.
But that's exactly what so many people said about Wagner when he was new. A lot of people said it about Verdi when he was
still
new too.
It still is the case. When you go to listen to a Wagner opera for the first time, it is very, very difficult. You probably fall asleep after half an hour only because you don't get the whole point.
But that's exactly my point.
I'm not wanna do anti-commercial for Wagner because I love this composer. I love him because I understood him.
No, my point is, I sound like I'm saying you ought to be singing new opera all the time.
I said in particular, sorry,
yeah,
the Second World War, because I strongly believe it has changed something in the naivety of humanity. We have forgotten to believe in the general trust and in the ideas that we all belong together, and it has broken something.
It turns on something about what we think the function of opera is, i.e. whether it's in repertoire that is challenging to begin with, like Wagner, or that's potentially more easy to understand, like Verdi's La Traviata, let's say. Are you doing it because you want to make people... You want to relax people? You want them to feel good about themselves? Or are you doing it because you want to communicate the big, difficult, often disturbing emotions always that these operas conjure up?
Yes, but what I don't want to do is I don't want to educate them, and I don't want to make a political statement. I don't want to provoke them. And that's what, unfortunately, we find nowadays in opera, for instance, in productions many times, that it's not so much about the piece itself. It's much more about what is the message that we want to bring across. And I would say to hell with the message. I mean, it's just because music wasn't written to another purpose than to entertain, unfortunately. I mean, entertain in every sense. Entertain also to touch people, to share sadness and joy.
But I mean, Wagner's operas were not written. They may be entertaining, but he wasn't setting out to entertain us. Think about the philosophy in Parsifal, the journey your character goes on. It's not simply surely it's not a question only of an entertainment there.
I mean, if you take every word there for granted, I mean, it is you cannot play Parsifal because this means you're actively missionarying the world for Christianity, which is, we all know, why would we do that now? I mean, we all leaned back a little bit on that and realized that there are other things that are more important than beat the other one to death only because he has another god that he believes in. And that is also in this possible. But you can see what I see too, that it's more a philosophic idea. It's more the journey that he cleans from this kiss of knowledge, of
its experience. These are
symbols for the different stages of what humanity is going through, and or what you as a character would. But again, I mean, he wrapped it in such a beautiful music, and without this music that takes your hand, if it would be too stressful, too uneven, that's what makes it difficult. It is much more difficult than other, but it is still in the harmonic world.
Thinking about a post-war composer who really did write tunes, Benjamin Britten, are you, Peter Grimes, are you tempted by all of those great tenor roles in the operas?
Oh, that's true. I mean, to be honest, there is no plan to do it so far, but the plan is in my head. I'm certainly trying to squeeze it in somewhere because
it's
I really
music,
want to do it.
It's music you like. It's music you
oh,
like.
It's absolutely. I mean, it is. That's great. But he's writing melodies. That's the point. I mean, it's always the key. You see, I've recently done, the Michelangelo sonatas from his, and which are absolutely brilliant, beautiful poems, but also the music is fantastic. It's in the Italian style, very, very light white and very... It's brilliant, really.
Peter Peer's voice, when you think of Britten's music, do you think automatically of his voice?
No. Don't ask me to say why, but I
why?
Personally... No, I mean, come on. I mean, they were a couple and they loved each other and everything. But I don't have to love his voice, don't I? I mean, only because I like Britten? No, I'm not sure.
Do you feel that connection with an audience physically when you're performing?
Yeah.
And therefore the difference between a night where you really feel that connection with the audience and sometimes where, for whatever reason, that doesn't happen,
Yes.
It's a sensation.
I can't tell you how, but you feel it. You feel it every time. Of course, you feel it much more when you're performing alone. When you do a lead recital, for instance, it's you can smell it, whether they are with you or not. And you can do something about it. It means that you have to work harder to convince them to be with you. But you certainly can also feel that on stage, even though you have the massive sound of the orchestra that probably cuts off all the sound that comes from the audience. So I don't know what it is, but you feel immediately when you got them, when you got their attention, when you see that they're hanging on your lips. It is something that changes the atmosphere. The air changes. I don't know.
did it happen at Covent Garden recently when you were performing Schubert's Winterreise on stage at the Opera House to about 3,000 people? I mean, was it possible there? And you also played the Winterreise in other big opera houses. So instead of small, intimate living rooms
absolutely
or leader houses...
And one of the ingredients, for instance, in this case, I was extremely surprised that compared to other venues... they were very, very good listeners. I mean, really, you could feel that they're there. And after a couple of songs, also the coughing and all the things came to an end or almost an end. And it was very, very intense. I could really feel that, again, that the audience was with me. I don't know whether the audience members who are listening now will all shake their heads and say, oh, nonsense, it was not the case at all. We were all snoring and they didn't hear us. I don't know.
is the leader recitals you give in general, do you find them essential to you as a musician? Or do they expose you in a different way and your voice?
Well, of course, they are exposing you in a way that probably nothing else can do. It is a burden, maybe, on one hand, because it means you have to carry it all on your own or on two pairs of shoulders, obviously. And the people are watching you constantly, so don't turn around, peel your nose or check your flyer or something on stage, obviously. Yeah? But this opportunity that they're all watching you is giving you the chance to reach them with very small, almost minimalistic things. Every little detail reads. it's a measurement also for yourself to not only be capable physically and mentally to concentrate through this entire evening, but also that the voice does all this, the sounds that you wanted to do, because there's nothing, no orchestra sound that covers up when you are a little bit rusty, or everything is there on the silver plate.
Your relationship with your audience, you are the weight of expectation that your fans around the world, and there are many of them, fan clubs and blogs, the whole thing. Are you aware of satisfying the demand for a piece of you that thousands of people around the world have?
Yes. I don't know what to do with it. I sometimes have the impression, as much as I love... I mean, you see, the moment you don't have anybody waiting at stage door for you, it's probably terrible, because I don't know, I don't want to think of that day. But sometimes you have the impression that there are fans that, with a ticket, they believe they bought a part of me too. So it's not only my performance, but it's just like, so now you belong to us, and now we can. That's sometimes irritating. You see, when somebody is talking to you on the street and they just say, oh, I just recognized you and may I ask you something, and it's just, but that's normal and it's totally fine. But it happened to me now so many times that you sit down somewhere in a restaurant at dinner, not related to right before or right after performance, and somebody just stands in front of your table staring at you until you reach up and they start talking, not saying, hello, good evening, may I disturb you? So they're just, what I always wanted to tell you is, and you think, do I know you? It is sometimes quite interesting what you experience.
But
nevertheless, I mean, it all shows you how powerful this is what we're doing.
That, in a way, that relationship with fans is partly about this bigger negotiation in your life between your professional life and your personal life. I mean, is that a difficult balance to strike now as always, or are you finding it easier now?
No, it's always difficult. I mean, it's a matter of, first of all, time, because this business is quite time-consuming. But it's also mentally quite something. You are fascinated by this music, but at the same time you are possessed almost by it. And
there must be times, you know, where separating yourself from a Parsifal or a Don Carlo, you must feel sometimes when you go home that you still are that person. In other words, just switching.
Yes,
it
well,
off
I
to
mean,
become,
yeah, yeah. I don't want to say that I changed my character and that I can't get rid of it. It's I can do it quite quickly. So it's the curtain goes down and I'm immediately, I believe at least, I'm immediately myself. But it's very tiring. You don't want to think about anything. You know, you want a beer and stare into the fire. I don't know. It's just... And of course you cannot, because you have a life to live and you need to somehow do it.
You have friends, you have family, you have people who have responsibilities. I mean, the real world is not just a
world
of
relaxation. Yeah, and they don't need to pamper you all the time, because that's not what life is about. I mean, it's not that they always say, oh, we have to treat him like a raw egg because he's about to perform next week. That would be ridiculous. Of course, it's my fault that I'm doing so much. But we were talking about the fans all over the world and the public demand that wants me on stage, and that for some reason don't accept that I have a private life and I want to have a week off. And so it's very difficult to combine these two worlds.
Is that harder? The more successful you become, is it harder?
Oh, yeah,
because you get used to it, the success and all everything that goes with that.
Yes, of course it's harder. I mean, it should be easy, actually. It should be easy because the more successful you are, the more you could have the courage to say, no, I'm not doing it. And you have to wait. No, it is not. Yeah, but it's complaining on a quite high level, of course.
Jonas, your image, I mean, if you buy a Jonas Kaufmann CD, it's your face and that fabulous hair on the cover. Does that get in the way? Do you think people occasionally think that one of the reasons they want a piece of you or want to hear you is because of the image? Is that an issue?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I have to say it was certainly an issue at the very beginning. My first album that I did, the so-called romantic arias, I had a sweater with the sleeves over the hands and so very... Yeah.
Smouldering.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And I realized, actually, that it did disturb me. I mean, I had the impression that they do something with me that I'm it's not me. And from that moment on, I try to change it. And what we have to accept, obviously, is the fact that if you don't sell a certain amount of CDs, they don't let you do another one. It is always a compromise.
But you are in control of that. I mean, you're
oh, yeah,
in control
of course
of
I am. Yeah, yeah, sure. There's not one image that comes out that where I haven't said, well, yeah, not one. It's difficult. 99%. There's always someone that slips through and you can't get rid of it anymore because we're in the electronic world never forgets.
This whole conversation is being recorded. It's a nice jumper, though, so you're fine.
Hi, ich versuch's. Sing ihm nach auf dem Rohr, tön ich ihm ähnlich, entrat ich der Worte, achte der Weise, sing ich so seine Sprache, versteh ich wohl auch, was es spricht.
There's a little glimmer or glint of something potentially possible in the future. The Wagner album you've recorded with Donald Runicles, there is a bit of the role of Siegfried, Wagner Siegfried on that record. Are you going to be singing Siegfried?
If God will and everything goes the way I think it goes, well, I want it to go, I'm certainly going to sing Siegfried. But Siegfried is a difficult part. I chose a part which can be sung much more lyrical than...
It's beautiful forest murmurs.
Yeah, but then he wrote other bits where you just need a voice that cuts through steel. Otherwise, you have no chance.
But
find this combination is quite difficult. I'm not afraid of doing it, but I think there are others that I have to do before. I want to end first the... Well, end, I mean, I want to do pretty much all the important Italian parts that I've planned to do,
which include Otello or the others.
Yeah, yeah, it's Otello. I mean, we have no Ballo e Maschera. Aida is missing. Turandot.
And you're doing Walter from the Meistersinger in 2016. But I mean, all that does seem to be paving the way towards the possibility of.
Yeah, yeah, it all goes in that direction. It's just a matter of how to pace it and what comes next. And we have the Siegfried in the Siegfried, and we have the Siegfried in Götterdämmerung, and we have two more Wagner parts that are waiting for me, which is the Tannhäuser and the Tristan. So the big question is, what comes first? I don't know. I actually have the tendency to do the Tannhäuser as the first, because I think, even though some people say it's much more demanding, it depends on the voice. It is probably less demanding for the non-typical Wagner voice, because there are many Italian phrases in it. So I think that might be the next one. But I don't have it in writing.
In Wahn und Lust zu finden, was an ihre warme Brust.
You heard it here first. Jonas Kaufmann will have the whole Wagner and Verdi canon under his belt, even if he keeps us waiting for a few years. For now, though, there's Puccini's Manon Lescaut at the Royal Opera House in London, a new production directed by Jonathan Kent, and you can hear it live here on BBC Radio 3 on Opera on 3 on Tuesday the 1st of July. But for now, I'll leave you with this taste of things to come and more of Wagner's Tannhäuser. Take it away, Jonas.
dieser Zauber tut sich auf. Die Hölle naht, ich fiel dem Lauf.
Thank you for listening to this download from BBC Radio 3. For more information about the items you've been listening to or to subscribe to the podcast, visit us online at bbc.co.uk/podcasts.